Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. In the 1890s, a band of robbers terrorized Butler County, running illegal beer joints, bilking the railroad, robbing businesses and the elderly, and murdering anyone who got in their way. It is the last decade of the 1800s. Fears of Jack the Ripper, still uncaptured, have Whitechapel and the rest of London on edge. Yet across the ocean in a small southern town in Alabama, murder runs so rampant even England is reporting the news. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Bad Boys of Butler County, A Band of Robbers, The True Story of John Hipp, Charles Kelly, the McKay Brothers, and Their Reign of Terror in the 1890s, with my special guest, author Sarah Sexton Miller. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Sarah Sexton Miller.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. It's a very fascinating tale, The Bad Boys of Butler County. Very interesting story. You are, as you write in the book, you are a self-taught genealogist who has been practicing for 24 years and enjoys using genetic genealogy to help others solve family mysteries. You were looking into the McKay ancestry, and you decided to do a newspaper search. What did you uncover, and tell us how you came to be the author of this book? Tell us this fascinating story of how you came to this.
Absolutely. So my family tree has been pretty big for a long time, but I had this one great-great-grandfather who I was curious to learn more about because he had moved to Mississippi and raised his family there, and some of his older children had returned to the area and raised their family. So I was curious about what took him to Mississippi, and I really had no information on him other than the factual things like his name, date of birth, you know, who he married, that type of stuff. But I wanted to know more about him as a person, and so I typed his name and did a little search in newspapers.com on the internet, and when I was reading the articles that I found about him, I was surprised to see his name in an article about John Hipp and Charles Kelly, who I did already have some knowledge of, and I knew that it was the right Herschel Johnson McKay because he had a brother named Duncan who was also listed with him in the articles. And so, like I said, I was very shocked because Charles Kelly and John Hipp were already pretty notorious in and around Butler County for being lynched in the 1890s for a series of murders that took place. But there had never been any mention of anyone else, or at least not in recent memory. And so to read that my relatives were members of this gang, and not just them, but there were also several other people who were mentioned. It really made me want to know more and dig in deeper because obviously there was a lot more to the story than what was being passed down.
Right. Now, this story is located in south central Alabama, with Greenville being the county seat. But this story also takes place primarily in Georgiana, Alabama. Is that the right pronunciation?
Georgiana.
Georgiana, okay. Also, tell us your connection to this area.
Well, I was actually born and raised here. I was born in a little community called Chapman, which is very near one of the crime scenes in the book. And it's maybe 3 miles from Georgiana, where a lot of the things take place. But I was born in a house there in Georgiana and was raised there. And I did leave for a little while and was in the military. But I came back home to raise my family and been here most of my life.
Okay, now let's get to the story. September 9th, 1891, and there's a merchant named Joseph Turrott, and he owns a
yes.
store. So what happens at his store September 9th, 1891, as you write?
Okay, so, and this is based mostly on newspaper accounts, and some newspaper accounts, you know, they tell the story a little differently than others. Writing was very flowery during that time, and sometimes accounts were embellished, it seems. So, you know, what I did was I took all of the accounts that I read and tried to get the most accurate description that I could based on
right.
how many things the accounts had in common. But apparently, Mr. Turrott had gotten up very early, about 3 a.m., and gone to a store because he wanted to prepare some papers for his son to take on the train to Greenville, which is maybe 16 miles north, when it would come through Georgiana later. And so when he entered the store, he propped his door open with a stool. And, you know, I think maybe he was just trying to allow in some natural light from the moon, because he lit 3 candles on his desk, but his desk was pretty far into the back of the store. And so he went in, and at some point while he was in there, he was accosted by, well, obviously at least one person. And he fought, you know, the evidence shows that he fought, but he ended up being shot at pretty close range and into the left side, but the bullet, it pierced his heart, his lungs, and it exited through his arm. And, I mean, his arm was just completely shattered.
Right. You write, at 4 a.m., a farmer heard a couple gunshots, and he approached the area, but he didn't see anything, so he left. Now, 30 minutes later, a black man who was carrying the mail walked by and saw the door open. What did
mm-hmm.
he say, or pardon me, what did he see and what did he do, and what did that precipitate other people doing?
Well, when he saw that the door was open, he said he could see the merchant lying on the floor inside, and he called out to him, and nobody answered, so he went and woke a neighbor. He didn't actually enter the store, which was probably a pretty wise decision on his part, but he went and woke the neighbor, and the neighbor went in and found the body, and it was said to be about 10 feet from the door, leaning against the counter. But people immediately, it was, I guess, part of the times that they lived in, but they immediately started jumping to some conclusions. And they said that they had seen some strangers around town. They had been described as mulatto, which is a term to describe a fair-skinned black person. And so there was a little speculation that these men had done the crime, and someone even said they had seen them running to the woods or the swamp. But pretty quickly, you begin to see articles about a man named Wiley Ricks being accused of the murder. And he was a heavyset black man who was about 35. And the main thing that I found as far as the suspicion on him was that it was said that he just happened to disappear right around the time of the murder. And so he was a suspect, but his family and friends all said, no, he's been here. He's been around. He's not disappeared. And it's unclear whether it was a wife or a girlfriend, depending on which article you read, but they did find some of his belongings at this woman's house. And supposedly there was a blood-soaked vest that they kind of used as some evidence that he was involved, which you know, I try not to give too much of my opinion in the book because I want it to be very factual. But in my opinion that I did not put in the book, I'm not sure why he would be blood soaked from shooting someone, unless maybe there was some, you know, some splash, some cast off blood. But to me, you know, it doesn't seem like the type of crime that would lead you to have blood soaked clothing.
Right. Now you say too, it's a, again, shockingly a product of the times that there was, later that night, a group of citizens from Georgiana attempted to take Ricks from the jail in Montgomery. And you had some notable people that were there to take him from the jail, not some miscreants, but tell us a little bit about this attempt.
Well, it wasn't the night of the crime, but it was, you know, the night that he was arrested. He was arrested on September 28th. And by the way, this is after another arrest of another black man had happened on September 9th. And he was supposed to have been the murderer. And then we get, you know, eventually Mr. Ricks was arrested on September 28th. And a group of angry citizens from Georgiana went to Montgomery, which is, you know, 60 miles or so from where we are. And they tried to get him from the jail. And it was a constable, Mr. Sims, that I believe was probably the same Mr. Sims who had been notified, the neighbor had been notified when he was found.
Right.
There's a GG tour, and I'm not sure exactly, but I mean, obviously he's a relative.
Sure.
And there were also others who were not named in the article, but, you know, it said there were a number of men. And luckily, the authorities were able to resist and not release Mr. Ricks to these men, because eventually the sheriff did go collect him and get him back, but certainly he would have been lynched if he had been released to them.
Right. Now you talk about September 28th, 1891, train number 3 of the Louisville and Nashville Railroad collided and killed a cow on the tracks. And the next day there was an ox tied to the tracks. What did what was the purpose of this, and how did they find out about the origins of why these cattle were tied to the tracks?
Okay, so in a case that at first seemed separate from the merchant's murder, there was a problem where people were tying sick animals who were bound to die, who were worthless. They would tie them to the railroad tracks. And when a train would hit the animal, they would claim damages from the railroad that they had, you know, hit their animal with the train. Basically, almost insurance fraud type scheme. So this had happened. And in one case, there was a man named Ben Dunn who had witnessed someone tying the animal to the tracks. And I believe his name was Charles Nichols or Charlie Nichols, and he became a witness or was planning to be a witness for the railroad. So Charlie Nichols was angry. Charlie Nichols' father, John Nichols, was angry. And the McKay brothers, who were very close, they were partners, so to speak, with the Nichols in the beer joint business. And so they began threatening Mr. Dunn to various people. And of course, Mr. Dunn ends up murdered right outside the home that one of the McKay brothers is using for an illegal beer joint, or a blind tiger, as they called it at that time, sort of like the North would have called a speakeasy or something.
Now, you write that Detective Barnes, as a result, arrests John and Charles Nichols and Johnson and Duncan McKay for the murder. And you write in the Standard Gauge, the newspaper at the time, that this was the latest edition of Rube Barrows and his gang. Now, just tell us briefly who Rube Barrows is.
So Rube Barrows was a notorious Alabama gangster who had He was actually a train robber. That was his main thing that he did. And he robbed trains, collected money, killed people, and basically terrorized people as well. But I have not found any actual physical connection between the two gangs other than the time period. It is possible that they had met up or known each other. And certainly Rube Burrows traveled through our area between his home and Florida, where he would go to and from. But so we're not really sure from the articles if they're saying that this gang is like fashioned after the Rube Burrows gang, or if perhaps there actually was some connection. But I tend to lean toward the just they're just in that fashion.
Now, in terms of it's interesting, you wouldn't think that there was an ability to get bond on charges like this, like murder. But regardless of whether they got bond, the McKay brothers were on the run, living between, you write, Garland, Alabama, and Mississippi. So they are charged for murder, but as you write, that November 2nd, 1891, just a month after the Dunn murder, tell us who is murdered on November 2nd.
Okay. So on November 2nd, 1891, there is an elderly couple, and maybe somewhere between 65 and 80 years, depending on which records, because record keeping back then was, you know, not the best, but the age varies. But this elderly couple, Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Shepherd, was found bludgeoned and murdered to death by way of axe. So it was a very gruesome, very bloody crime scene. And the axe was actually found in the yard near the home afterwards. But, you know, there were witnesses who said that they heard people yelling and arguing at the time of the murders. And so they believe that it was a group of men who actually committed the murders.
You write also that the axe, blood-covered axe, was found about 30 yards from the house. And mm-hmm. the locals presumed at that time who had murdered Dunn and who had murdered the Shepherd couple. What was the speculation? Mm-hmm. What would they speculate who did this?
So the speculation was that whoever had murdered Ben Dunn was responsible for the Shepherd murders. I think mostly just because of the proximity in time, and also because that men were seen or heard around the time of the murder. There was arguing, they left, they came back, and then the murder took place. But the Shepherds, there was speculation that the Shepherds actually knew too much about the case, the charges against John and Charles Nichols. Now, where that information actually came from, or what connection the Shepherds had to this murder, whether it was to Ben Dunn or the Nichols or the McKays, I really could not find any further information other than this mention in the newspaper.
Now, you say in response to these murders, these people have an idea who did this. So what do angry citizens do in response to these murders?
Well, they blamed the beer and the booze and the Blind Tigers, especially since the McKays ran a Blind Tiger. And also
right.
John Hipp had been mentioned during the time of the Ben Dunn murders, not as a potential murderer, but just as one of the people who was running one of these Blind Tigers owned by the Nichols. So the Nichols owned them, but John Hipp ran one of them, and the McKays ran one of them. And they were just blaming the alcohol and the establishment for the problems in the community. And so when the Shepherds were murdered, they actually burned down several of these establishments. And it was even rumored that in one of the establishments, a man had been inside and had been burned alive.
Now, you write that Detective D.W. Barnes, who works for the Louisville-Nashville L&N Railroad, and Chief Porterfield of Greenville investigated the case. very much like what's characterized, November 5th, there's an arrest of Mr. and Mrs. Edmund Moore, a black couple who lived 2 miles from the Shepherds. And they found some blood-spattered pants, apparently, and on his shoes as well. But soon after, Moore was released. So the bloody clothing was sent for analysis. So now you have November 5th, 1981. Detective Barnes found a decomposed body in a mud hole. Now tell us about Swede, about this person missing Swede and its relation to this case.
Yes, I'm sorry, that's 1891. But yes, so there's a Swedish man who was apparently missing, and I had never found any articles about him going missing. And once I found this article about him being located, I actually looked for articles about his disappearance and could not find any. But this man worked at Chapman, and Chapman is a community, but we call this sawmill that's in Chapman Chapman as well, even though that's not actually its name. Like if somebody says, I work at Chapman, they're talking about the sawmill. And so this man worked at the sawmill. He was a Swede. And apparently he had disappeared about a month before. And when they found the body, it was in a ditch that had been filled with water. It was a wet time, and it was filled with water. But as it had begun to dry, his body had been exposed. And he had been shot, and he had been weighted down with, like, chunks of wood in this ditch. And the body was so decomposed, they identified it by the boots that it was wearing. And I think it was a belt that he was wearing that was, I guess, was easily recognizable. And so people knew that this was the missing man.
Right. Involved with the investigation and the characters that will ultimately are ultimately big figures in this, and that's Sheriff Brown, and he had made, as you write, William Henry Bargainer, brother of his successor, Deputy John Bargainer, became sheriff November 1892. So you say that they were interested in looking for a person named Jeff Watts, who was wanted in Wilcox County. And anyway, they get to looking for this Watts, but we get to the story of Charles Jake Armstrong. So tell us a little bit about what happens with this Watts and introduce who Charles Jake Armstrong is.
Okay. So with Watts, he was wanted for something completely unrelated to what was going on in Georgiana and Butler County. But it was during his attempted arrest that one of the Bargainers was killed. And the only reason I mention it in this book is because I read another book that had put his death, his murder, in with the Kelly Hip crimes and said he was one of their victims. And he actually was not one of their victims. And so I just only included him just to kind of clear that up, that he was actually killed in the line of duty while attempting to arrest someone that was in a totally unrelated incident.
So tell us about Charles Jake Armstrong, the tax collector, and what happens with him December 17th, 1892.
So, yes, his murder was probably the most famous of the murders. And it's really definitely not any more heinous than the Axe murders. But he was a very popular figure in the community. He was a Civil War veteran, and he had lost a leg. So he was, he came back crippled or half crippled, and he had been elected to serve as the tax collector. And at some point, he had actually been appointed. I think he had been elected one time and appointed another time when someone else couldn't do it. But in any case, he was serving as the tax collector at this time. And in those days, the tax collector would be out, you know, for quite a while because he's traveling by horse and buggy and going to different farms all over the county collecting taxes. And he would have this money on him. So it was, you know, kind of a dangerous job. So he would have been well armed and, you know, they would have wanted someone who was experienced with fighting, such as a veteran. But he went out collecting, and it was during this time on December 17th when he was crossing a bridge across the Panther Creek, and he was waylaid and killed by at least two people. But actually, when they were investigating early on, they said they were thinking it was three people. So I don't know what exact evidence they found for that, but they believe they were looking for three people. And it's interesting because when they found two people, and then that third person was not mentioned again for a while. And the two people who they found was John Hipp and Charles Kelly, that they believed to be the killers. And the reason that they believed them to be the killers is that they had been in the area that day, and there were witnesses that they were in the area. And they were certainly thought to be capable of such a crime.
You write that it was speculated that they spent the night at their aunt's cell, John's aunt's home, Martha Hipp Myrick.
Home
was very close. You say a half a mile away from this Panther Bridge.
Yes. And Martha actually, I don't want to use the word testified, but she actually gave an account that they stayed with her and her two daughters the night before. And it was odd because they were getting up early in the morning to go do some job at the sawmill. I can't remember right off the top of my head right now, but they were going to go do this job in Dunham. And Dunham was like 7 miles from Martha's house, but it was very close to John Hipp's house. So,
right.
You know, for him to spend the night with her when he had to go do this job that would have been right by his house, it was very odd. But they got up very early, and the women fixed them a bite to eat, and they left. And, you know, they made a comment not to tell anybody they had been there. And then it was shortly after this, like maybe I think it was about 9 a.m., when the women had gone out for a walk. And they had walked across the bridge and had actually passed Mr. Armstrong and had greeted him and kept walking. Well, they walked around a curve, and then they hear a gunfire. And so they turned and they could see smoke, and they ran toward the incident, and they realized what had happened, and they went to get a relative whose name was also Myrick to get help.
Right. Now, you also say that they got to see the body of Armstrong and his horse. And and so Porterfield, Oliver Byrant, Chink Williams, all these people on December 18th believe that they're hunting for Hipp and Kelly. And so it's a massive manhunt, isn't it, undertaken?
Yes, I mean, they gathered up a posse of not just law enforcement people, but, you know, back then, if there was if you needed more force than you normally kept on hand, you had trusted people that you could count on to come join in with your posse to go on this manhunt. And so that's what they did. And they actually received word from a train conductor that he was supposed to meet John Hipp to deliver some whiskey in the woods, because back then they had trains that would run through the woods to do the logging business. And a lot of times, you know, it was very, it wasn't as formal as travel is today and things like that. And people would hop trains and whatnot, but John Hipp was out there. And so when the train went into the area where he was going to be and where they knew he was going to be, they kind of set it up and hid on the train. And so sure enough, John Hipp stops the train and you know, the train is up a good bit higher. The floor of the train is kind of chest high to him. So he lays his weapon down to reach up into the train, and that's when the sheriff comes out and shoots him.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop just for a second for these commercial messages. We were talking about, Sarah, just about when he was captured, when he was shot. Tell us about more about this capture and the condition of John Hipp.
Well, he was very, very injured. And in some accounts, he was mortally injured. And he wasn't expected to, like, make it even all the way back to Greenville. And then once back to Greenville and in the jail, he wasn't expected to make it through the night. But John Hipp was apparently a very tough character because he's in the jail. He's, by some accounts, there's brain matter coming out. And yet, apparently, he lived long enough to be lynched. So, and I think that the reporter at the time was saying that he didn't think that there would be a lynching because he thought, you know, with the condition of the perpetrator and then with his accomplice also being captured not long afterward and brought to jail, that he didn't think there would be a lynching. But unfortunately, he also reported on John Hipp's miraculous recovery and how he was at one point up walking around. And so I think that, you know, people understanding that this man might live, you know, was not helpful. So, but yeah, we find out that Charles Kelly had actually ran off and he had gone to a nearby area in Pineapple, Alabama. And he was captured and brought back to Greenville. So they were both in the county jail in Greenville. And even the Myrick women had been brought to the jail and were being held there and being questioned. And, of course, the girls were terrified and were just like, Mama, just tell them whatever they want to know so we can go home. And also John Hipp's brother-in-law, Mr. Stokes, William Stokes, had also been brought in. I mean, they were just rounding up anybody basically that was in the family that might be able to help, tell them anything to help seal their case. But no one was saying, we saw this happen, we know they did it. But there was evidence, you know, even though forensics back then, I'm sure, was nothing like forensics is now, they knew before they ever found the men that they would be injured. They knew that Mr. Armstrong had fought and that he had caused injury to his killers. And so it was just amazing to me, like how much they knew back then. I wouldn't have thought that they would have figured out a lot of what they figured out, including that there was a third person. But at this time, they were saying, oh, it's just the two of them, because that's who they found, was two people.
Right.
And, yeah.
You write that they set a preliminary trial for January 4th and 5th, and now this is December 28th, so it's not like there was going to be a long wait for at least the preliminary trial. But as you write, the newspaper had already made, beyond speculations, they had already made, and like they had direct evidence of guilt for this gang, for Hipp and Kelly especially. So, and as you write, they also, the reporter said that he was, even though he was injured, he was walking around the cell that day. So as you write, and you imply, that there was a lot of anger over even that these guys might live, these murderous gang members. So December 29th, you write, there was a lynch mob, and they hung them from the columns on the porch of the Butler County Courthouse. Was there
yes.
any attempt to hide their actions at all? And what were the bodies left for in terms of shock value?
You know, well, there were like 100 some odd men from accounts who attended this lynching. And miraculously, nobody saw anybody. Nobody knew who did it. I think that there was just a really widespread sentiment that these men did not deserve a trial, that they weren't worthy of wasting the time and energy on a trial. And, you know, immediately, like, even though their names had never really come up in any of the previous murders, once they were caught for the Armstrong murder, suddenly they were guilty of all the murders. And, you know, I do believe that they were certainly involved in at least some of the murders, and probably directly in at least probably the Shepherd murders, but without any, you know, firm proof. I mean, like I said, their names had not even really come up. We heard of John Hipp a little bit because of the beer joint, and then Charles Kelly had not been mentioned at all before now. And so suddenly these are these two murderers who have been on this rampage. And it said that, like John Hipp, it said that he has the grit of 40 hells. Like he's just demonized, and, you know, maybe rightfully so, but with the times the way they were, and, you know, people were very tight-lipped. All these people were there, but nobody knows anything. And the bodies were hung from, so the porch was elevated, and there was like an entry under the porch for like the bottom floor, and then you could go up the porch to get to the next floor. And so up there, they hung them from the column, and then they just, you know, hung them over the side of the porch. And John Hipp was, you know, in some speculate that he was probably already dead by the time they hung him. Like, they were so determined to hang this man who had been shot not only by the sheriff, but also by Armstrong before him. Like, he had been injured before he was ever caught, which is probably why he wanted some whiskey so bad. But, yeah, they were so after these men that they actually probably hung a dead man. But certainly Charles Kelly had not been injured. He turned himself in. Well, not turned himself in, but when he was captured, he surrendered. He didn't fight. He went willingly. And so he was actually in very good shape when he was hung. But the next day, people get up and they go downtown to go about their business, and there's these bodies hanging from the courthouse. There was no attempt whatsoever to hide what they had done. And certainly it was probably a warning to others, and we know now the McKays and the Nichols and others like them that, hey, this is going to stop. Like, we're not going to put up with this anymore. You're going to stop this killing and this craziness that's going on in our community.
Yeah. You write that William Stokes, the brother-in-law of Hipp, John Hipp, was arrested the same time as Hipp, was released on December 29th, right after that lynching, or the next day after that lynching. He was released and charges dropped, wasn't he?
Yes. And I'm not sure that they ever really had anything on him ever to begin with, other than, you know, he was a relative, apparently very tight with John Hipp. But I think that probably the lynching, you know, that they didn't want to be responsible, maybe, if anybody realized, oh, we missed one, and they came back. So I think that they just said, okay, justice has been done, and you can go. Take him home and bury him. But a strange thing actually happened a little while after all of this. So it's been a few weeks since the lynching and since the murder of Armstrong, and someone finds another body under the bridge where Armstrong was murdered. And in all of the newspaper clippings that I found, I really could not find a first name for this man. He was just a man named Smith, who was said to have been a very bad character. And he was believed to have been a third assassin of Armstrong, whose body had just gone unnoticed because it was like off and under the woods, into the woods a little bit. And so they had just missed it in all their fine forensics. And they even knew that there was probably three people at the time. But, you know, due to the lynching we will never really know what part exactly that Mr. Smith played in all of this.
Well, you speculate about the money that was stolen from Armstrong, and there was some money found later, but tell us what your idea, your theory is about this large amount of money and what it says about this.
Well, actually, most of the money that Mr. Armstrong had collected was still on him. I can't remember the exact hiding place off the top of my head, but he had it hidden on his person. And also, I imagine that when the shooting happened, they had to make a quick getaway. You know, one of them had been killed. Another one had been injured. And so I don't think they had a lot of time to really search. And they didn't get a lot of money. I believe the amount was about $12, I think. Maybe it was 16. Yeah. But in any case, the amount that had been taken from Mr. Armstrong was the same amount of money that had been found on Charles Kelly when he was taken in.
Now you talk about, you introduced George Mason in 1893. And about this oath not to betray gang members. And if you have to, you have to kill somebody if they betrayed the gang. But at the same time, the preliminary trial for the murder of Ben Dunn is October 20th, 1891. So I guess we're jumping ahead with George Mason, 1893. Tell us about John Charles Nichols and Johnson and Duncan McKay. What happens in their trial?
So these trials just went on forever. Like they would get them, they would let them out on bond, they would disappear. And it took a long time. Like, I don't even remember exactly how many years, but it was well after the lynchings. It took a very long time for these trials to actually come to a close. So in the end, they actually didn't serve very much time at all. And I'm trying to remember, I'm sorry, I get caught up on the actual lynching part, but they end up being released and Nichols, Charles Nichols, the really ironic thing about Charles Nichols is that, you know, this began when he was trying to bilk the railroad. So Charles Nichols actually goes on to work for the railroad for a very long time until the end of his life, and apparently turned his life around.
You talk about during the trial of Nichols and the McKays that a person named George Mason began to share tales of the Rube Barrows gang, lumping the McKays, Nichols, Jeff Archer, Hip and Kelly, and others as an organized gang of robbers. And so he gave all these incredible details at this trial. Tell us a little bit more about George Mason and what he tells them about this gang and Hip Kelly's complicity in these crimes.
Yes, so it's about 6 months after the lynching, and George Mason offers testimony about this gang, and it's really kind of a really far-fetched, like it's a really elaborate tale, but at the same time, in some ways, it's actually pretty believable. But he was an engineer, and he was running a train for the Dunham Lumber Company, and we know that John Hip lived around Dunham. But, you know, he said that at one point, you know, John Hip had hitched a ride on his train, and he had dropped a letter. And so after Hip had left, Mason read the letter. And the letter was kind of like a constitution of this gang. Like they actually had written up their bylaws and how things were going to be. And as you said, like they had agreed to killing and stealing and robbing, and they were going to divide all the proceeds with one another, but they were sworn to secrecy. And so later they come back and they want to know, hey, you seen my letter? John Hip wants to know, you seen my letter? And so Mason says, yeah, I have the letter, but I didn't read it. And of course, they don't believe him. So they try to figure out, okay, what are we going to do about this? So they decide to bring him in, like, you know, they're going to have to bring him in because now he knows too much. So it's either that or, you know, so Charles Kelly waylays Mason and holds him up with two pistols, not one, but two pistols, and says, you know, we're going to go get some fish out of a trap. So it's like, no, I don't want to go get any fish out of a trap. I'm good. I'm good. And it's like, no, you're coming. You're coming. So they take him and they actually initiate him into the gang. And he is supposed to actually, you know, set up a train robbery. And he didn't, he wasn't really happy about that because apparently, I think it was his brother was involved somehow. Like his brother worked for that train or was, you know, an engineer or conductor on that train or something. But, you know, he's really hesitant. But luckily for Mr. Mason, like that was about the time of the tour and Shepherd's killings. And the gang's like, okay, we've got to lay low. We've got to stop what we're doing for a while and lay low because they're going to be on to us. And so Mr. Mason gets out of having to become a criminal because of that one thing and also gets out of being murdered. And that, you know, that actually kind of does explain one thing because there actually was a pause. It was probably about a year between the last murder and then the Armstrong murder. So there was like this pause, this time of relative peace for a while before the final killing.
What about, you write about Rube Barrows. Again, we just mentioned it briefly. To the truth that this was Rube Barrows, part of a Rube Barrows gang? How's that? You dismiss that. But tell us a little bit more about the possibility that they were involved with Rube Barrows or just influenced.
Mm-hmm. So Rube Barrows actually died in 1890, which, you know, it's around the time these things are happening. But before his death, you know, he did a lot of travel by train back and forth between Florida and his home, which was somewhere like up north of us. And so, I mean, he did pass through the area. He certainly was in Montgomery because I believe that's where his brother was killed when they attempted to do a train robbery there. And right. So, as I was saying, like, it's very possible that our guys met him, but certainly they wanted to emulate him. And so the gang was probably more just styled after him, especially since he died so close around this time, than there was that he actually was a part of this. But now he did hide out for a long time and, you know, in different areas in the woods. And so, you know, you never know. They could have hit him out for a while.
Porterfield, you write that there may have been a reward. So there might have been some motivation, as it seemed, to arrest people on any suspicion to try to get something done in the face of the public. Was a reward, and tell us a little bit about that reward controversy, if any.
Reward controversy. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to there. I honestly don't remember there being a reward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked about the media, and in this book you provide, very interestingly, the newspaper clippings of the time to sort of demonstrate, as you mentioned, the flowery language and sort of the sensationalistic nature of their coverage. Tell us a little bit more about some of the things you include, the newspaper articles that you include, and their sources.
Yeah, so I wanted this book to be not like my opinion because there have been several, well, there are at least a couple of books on the topic by amateur authors like myself. And I've read them. And one of the things that, you know, I wanted to do was set the record straight about some things that I knew from the other books were not true. And originally, it actually started from the genealogical point of view because I had read a book in which John Hipp was said to have been from Coleman, Alabama. And it was written by the great-great-grandson of a John Hipp from Coleman, Alabama. And he thought that this was his ancestor. And so he wrote this fictional, based on reality type novelization about the event. I do think he really believed that this was his great-great-grandfather. But because of, you know, the McKays being involved, I was doing the genealogy on it, and I was trying to figure out who John Hipp really was. And so I went at it from the angle of, okay, he's right. So I'm going to source it. I'm going to prove it. I'm going to prove he's right. And I couldn't do that. There just wasn't any evidence that his ancestor was the same John Hipp. In fact, the birth dates were like 10 years off. And right. So then I said, okay, so he's probably not, because we know that John Hipp had an aunt named Martha Myrick, and I can't prove any such relation in this other family. And so then I decided to go at it from just researching who John Hipp really was. And I discovered that he was born and bred right here in Butler County. And his mother was actually a single mother, which is kind of odd at the time. And he was actually her second child born out of wedlock. And so she was actually born a Hipp, and Martha Myrick was her sister, Martha Hipp, who had married a Myrick. So, you know, just in the beginning, it was mostly about the genealogy and trying to set that straight. But then I found all these interesting articles that really told the story in a way that, in all the years of listening to rumors and hearsay, that I had never really heard or understood the story. And so my goal was to share what I had found without embellishing it. And so I actually, you know, I kind of summarize in each chapter, like, this is a summary of the articles I'm about to share with you. And then I share the articles so people can read them for themselves, because, you know, it's not my goal to just plagiarize and take all of the information from these articles and retell it. I really want people to see it for themselves and make up their own minds, especially since, like I said, some of the articles contradict each other. So it's not up to me to determine which ones are 100% correct or which ones are wrong. In some cases, I can, you know, find other evidence from other types of records that are more sound than newspaper articles. Mm-hmm. But usually you really do have to just take it all. It's just like today's media. I mean, they're going to tell it three different ways, and you just have to kind of use your intellect and your knowledge and kind of determine what you're going to believe. And that's really what I wanted to provide for people who don't have the time or the funds or whatever to do all this research. It's just, okay, here it is for you. Here are the articles, and have fun reading them and come to your own determination.
You started this by looking up the genealogy of the McKay family. Now that you've done this and uncovered all these things that you had no idea of, what has been their response?
Well, I mean, it's been actually it's been pretty cool, because, like, that was actually the uptight Christian side of my family.
Okay.
I have, like, a moonshine side of my family. And so this was the side of my family that was more tight-lipped and, you know, like, Pentecostal Church of God Christian, you know, family. So I really was not expecting to find gang members and murderers and that sort of thing on that side. You know, I knew I had it, but this was a surprise to see that it was also on the side of my family. And I was kind of worried because, you know, one of my aunts that's on Facebook, you know, that's a generation up closer to this, these happenings, you know, and I was like, okay, let's see how they're going to take it. And they're actually like, cool, you know, when can I get the book? So I'm like, okay,
right.
this is not too bad. They're enjoying this too. It's not shaming anyone. No one is taking it personally, you know, so that's good.
What was the future of Herschel Johnson McKay and Duncan Day McKay, as you write?
So, yeah, they actually they married a pair of sisters, and they were married during the time that these things were happening too, by the way. But so Johnson McKay, he went on to Mississippi, as I had mentioned, and, you know, he actually stayed there and, you know, had children there, and he's I don't think he ever really fully returned. Now, Duncan McKay, he did return, but not to Butler County. He ended up staying in a place called Off, which is, you know, maybe a couple of hours from where we live now. It's in Alabama. It's not that far, but I guess, you know, in the 1800s, it would have been probably far enough to start a new life maybe and, you know, be close enough to visit family, but far enough to go on with your life. And so once they had done their jail time and they got out and they went on and lived their lives. And I don't think that they had any other major issues, or at least not that I've been able to find.
You write in the, when you first start researching this, there was that, the legend, the myth of Hip and the gang and calling it a Rube Burrows gang. You said that this was very, very interesting when it came to terms of information, and you called it misinformation. How hard was it to sort through everything? How interesting was it to sort through all that, what you call misinformation, to get to the truth in this matter?
It was pretty interesting. And honestly, before, when I was younger, I had looked into Kelly and Hip some, but at the time, looking into things was different than it is now. We didn't have all of the resources that we do now. So back then, I went to the genealogy library, it's the genealogy room, actually, in the Butler County Library. And I actually wasn't looking up Kelly and Hip at the time when I discovered Kelly and Hip. My maiden name is actually Kelly. And so when, no relation to Charles Kelly, I don't think, we have not been able to determine actually exactly who he was. But I was looking under Kelly in the folder. They have a file cabinet, and it has these folders, and it just has like clippings and copies of things that people have, you know, contributed. And so I found some copies of some clippings about Hip and Kelly, but mainly it was just the ones right when they were lynched. There were no, like, the articles all around all the murders and all the details. And so I was like, oh, cool. You know, but at the time I was told by other people my age, you know, not people who would have really known, but I was told by people that, oh, they were these outlaws from somewhere, and they came from far away, and then they just rampaged and murdered people and they were hung. You know, it really wasn't known to me at that time that these were locals and that there was so much history behind it. And so, you know, I kind of had looked at it before and I knew a little bit about it, but I also had a lot of wrong information. And so when I started looking at it again after I discovered the McKay connection, luckily we now have the ability, as long as something has been indexed or uploaded or scanned, you know, we can really reach across the years and we can sort of time travel. Honestly, it's amazing. Like when you're sitting there and you're pulling up these articles and you're reading them and just, you know, it's almost like you can just picture it and it's like you're there. But the misinformation, like I would say, is the more, like, as you went through the years, like you start getting to 1950 and people start in the newspaper, start revisiting, oh, remember the Hip and Kelly lynchings and all the murders they committed. And so these older people who were like young children at the time it happened start telling their stories. And some of those stories, you know, they don't jive with what actually happened, but it's fun to read them anyway.
Absolutely. Well, you've done an admirable job with your research, and thanks to your love of genealogy, you stumbled across this incredible story and then put it together, did the necessary research, incredible amount of research, and put this together to bring us The Bad Boys of Butler County, A Band of Robbers, The True Story of John Hip, Charles Kelly, the McKay Brothers, and the Reign of Terror in the 1890s. I want to thank you very much, Sarah Miller, for this interview. Is there an Amazon page, a Facebook page? How can people find out more about this book?
So there actually is a Facebook page called The Bad Boys of Butler County, and the link to the Amazon listing for the book is there. It is a self-published book. It was just the fastest way to get it out there, and I was really, like, not about making money at all. My goal is to, like, get this out there. Like, I'm so excited by it, and I want other people to be excited. And a lot of our locals are, but it's not the kind of thing that, you know, it's not for everybody, because if you're from here, it means a lot more, I think. But hey, the more the merrier. I would love for people to read it.
Yes, absolutely. It's a fantastic read. Thank you so much, Sarah Sexton Miller, for this interview. You have a great evening. Good night.
You too.